Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey, listener, Zach Harper here. Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. Here's how it works. The Pick'em game. Pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower stat total in this week's game for a chance to win big. How big, you ask? I'm so glad you asked that question, listener. You can win up to 100 times your money in a single night. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick'em entry. You can also do rivals picks. You can put like Tyrese Haliburton and Jalen Brunson against each other, and whoever has more points, more assists, more rebounds, whatever you want to do, that is your rivals pick. I would maybe go with Jalen Brunson in these playoffs. By the way, in the regular season, Jalen Brunson, scoring tear, going higher on his point totals all the time. Joel Embiid, whenever he did actually play, higher on his scoring totals all the time. Victor Wembanyama, for the next 15, 20 years, here's a pro tip for you, take higher on the blocks. That's right. So you're probably wondering, how do you sign up? Oh my God, listener, you are full of good questions today. Sign up with the promo code DING, that's D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. $250, man, that's a lot. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the App Store. And don't forget to register with our code DING, D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick and first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. Must be 18 or older, 21 or older in Massachusetts, Arizona, 19 or older in Alabama and Nebraska, and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.ncpgambling.org. Arizona 1-800-NEXT-STEP, that's 1-800-639-8783, or text NEXT STEP to 53342. New York, call the 24/7 HOPE line at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY, or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, all sentient beings listening to this podcast. It's time for another episode of Woke Bros. I am your illustrious co-host, Michael Jamal Brooks, joined as always by my friend, compadre, and podcast partner,
big Waz. Waz, how you doing?
I'm good. Welcome back to the Woke Bros sphere.
Oh, man. You know that this is where you want to be, everybody.
Of course.
And of course, well, he's here, but he's in and out.
Yeah.
We have our junior genius, evil genius in training, Rob Lopez, taking us through the ones and twos. As always, up top, subscribe to the pod if you haven't already. Leave us a review. Check out all of the Count the Dings and athletic properties. Check out the Michael Brooks Show. Check out everything on Patreon and YouTube and all the rest. And we'll get – and also we'll get into more details about stuff after. We're not going to load you up on plugs up top. But start by making sure if you haven't already to subscribe to the bomb feed and leaving us a review. A lot of stuff to tackle today. We're talking about political prisoner Lula da Silva. We've talked a lot about him on my show, certainly on this show a little bit. He just gave an incredible interview that was subtitled into English to Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept that has lessons on his situation. But he actually, even though he's a political prisoner in solitary confinement, he has strategic insights about how to defeat the far right and what really being what left wing, what like actual grounded people politics is all about. Obviously I'm a big fan of the man, but I thought it really was incredible. And we're going to tackle that. I want to know all of Waz's thoughts on that. And then we got to talk about Rihanna. It's an incredible accomplishment of her in terms of being the first black woman to take over a major fashion house in Paris. The celebration of this Wall Street, of this New York Times interview, and all the things it means. It's positive. It's interesting. It's Rihanna. And then it would have been Biggie Smalls' 47th birthday this week. So we're going to touch on that and revisit the 1990s and Ready to Die. So a lot to hit.
So many goodies. So many delectable treats on this episode of The Woke Pros, Mike.
I mean, seriously.
Hey, sometimes –
yeah,
sometimes the content gods just bless you with an incredible week. And these are one of those weeks because, you know, one, this is the first time I've actually ever heard Lula speak. And he's an incredibly captivating speaker. He's very inspirational in that way.
You know what, Waz, please, that's exactly actually how I wanted to start. So can we just say, like, probably most people in the audience are, you know, they're not going to be people like me who've watched this dude and been covering and all of this. But, you know, like, and I mean, okay, you know, obviously you cover politics. You know, it's part of what you do right. For a living and what you do. But if this was your first time watching the dude, and I know you know about it from me and the shows yes. And everything, but what were all your impressions of him just as a communicator, as a leader, his idea, like whatever, just lay it all out.
You know what? As many gripes as I have with Glenn Greenwald, the sort of media personality, I think his abilities and his skills as a journalist are unimpeachable, right? In the sense that clearly he's a Lula sympathizer, but he can effectively communicate what the critiques are. And what I like about Lula is that, yes, I'm not parrying your question, which is like the most expert skill that U.S. politicians have, right? It's like I can get your little critical question and I can sort of parry it and repivot and, you know, sort of reestablish my post-up position, if you will, to borrow a basketball analogy. What I like about Lula is that he's like, not only do I hear your question, I know exactly where it's coming from and why people might think this is a problem for me, but here's why it's not. Right? Like that, I don't know, the clarity, to me, that's what makes him effective. It's his clarity of purpose. His clarity of intentionality that separates him from your run-of-the-mill politician. You know, I feel like his mission is very simple, right? It's like, what do we do to help our most downtrodden people? Sometimes on the road to that, we have to do things that we may not like. that, you know, the sort of the judge and jury, you know, the people on their high horse of the of my sort of political purview, in his case being the left, that might give them, you know, an angle to critique me and what I do. But at the end of the day, my mission is clear. My mission is so freaking easy for me to understand what I have to do because I know who I'm doing it for and why I'm doing it. I was just impressed with his because, you know, Greenwald brought up the idea that, well, the elite and the bankers also got rich too, you know, as if that's some kind of critique when the guy's lifting up millions and millions and millions of people out of straight up despair. Like, that's not even hyperbolic. Despair, abject poverty. I think it's instructive for leftward leaning people in America what he said. He was like, look, in a Congress of 500 and something people, only 90 of them were from my party, right? So I have an objective and I have a goal. I have to figure out who are the people that are going to help me reach my objective. Now, some of their objectives may be shit that I don't like, but guess what? It's in service of getting my shit done.
Yeah.
Which I think is it's just an incredible message of coalition, how coalitions actually work, right? Like, especially in a coalition like the Democratic Party, where you just have so many factions and factors. The measure of an effective leader is finding a way to get us to the destination, right? We might not like the path. We might have to go through some seedy ass neighborhood, right? Well, we might get robbed and killed, but guess what? We got home. You know what I'm saying? Like, unless we got home.
I love everything you're saying. And I think, I mean, I also just say, like, you know, if you haven't heard him speak or watched him speak yet, he's got this very distinctive, like almost growl, like, boy, and I love the part because it's all in Portuguese, but I love how he's just like, when Greenwald's pushing him and he's just like, Glenn, like, yeah, like, I got it. Which is what I think is funny is, like, you know, like, I do, like, I love that you noted that distinction between Glenn as a journalist versus, like, Twitter provocateur. And, you know, like, I sometimes talk, like, I DM'd with Glenn a little bit, actually, even before this interview, you know, and I definitely have a lot of respect and like Glenn Greenwald, think he's an important voice, even as I disagree with him, which I think, by the way, we need to do more of that in general. Like, there's a lot of things I disagree with him on, there's a lot of things I agree with him on, but overall, especially when you're focusing on his writing or his interviewing, I mean, this is a brilliant guy. There's things about the interview that I would have done much differently, frankly, right? But, you know, it had a huge value. But I did think that the way he said that, to me, I was thinking of all of the people. Like, I even thought of you, of just like, Glenn, like, all right.
We get it. We get what you're doing right here. Okay, let me get to it.
It's so instructive, man. Because first of all, yes, this is a leader, and I'll just reset because I think on one hand there's the dimension of who we are in the United States and the fact that we have backed. And I have no question. I mean, basically, the real short version of the story is that Lula was president from 2003 to 2010. Then his successor from the same party, also a very interesting politician, her name was Dilma Rousseff, was president from 2010 to 2016. And then she was removed in what is universally recognized as an illegitimate coup, basically. Like, the Congress removed her for budget irregularities, and I could tell you the closest analogy would have been is if the Republicans were just like, oh, well, Obama gave us a bad number on something. Like, that budget projection wasn't real. We're gonna impeach him. So the removal of her was incredibly corrupt. And Lula left office literally with an 86% approval rating, and he had lifted at least basically about 40 million people out of, like, extreme poverty, basically from, like, starving to being somewhere in the middle class, and then did a huge amount for labor unions. I mean, that was, if you are thinking of politics from the perspective of what benefits people, he's the best president we've had in the 21st century so far, right? And but the elite in Brazil, and that was, and also the United States, because I definitely think like the United States has been part of this process, and you know, we can't get into all of it now, but he's in jail in a process where there was no evidence produced. It's basically all based off of a coerced plea bargain testimony for accepting this seaside apartment. It's a case that does not pass muster by any standard. And he was put in jail and silenced during the 2018 race where he led in all of the polls, right? And his perspective, which I tend to agree with, is that even though he was very conciliatory in a way and willing to make a lot of deals with everybody, I mean, there was a period of time where this guy had good relations with everybody from Bush to Iran, but he had a lot of focus on other countries in Latin America, Africa. He was very admired in Europe. You know, he wouldn't allow certain parts of Brazilian national resources and specifically oil resources to be open to foreign investment and U.S. investment. And that definitely does correlate with the Department of Justice cooperating very aggressively in this very politicized campaign against him and his political party. But so there's that element. And he also said, like, look, like, the reason that we've been undone is because of the successes we've had, that even though they did great under my presidency, a lot of the Brazilian elite just hate to see poor people in planes. Yeah. They hate to see poor. And I think that to me was very interesting because, and he was also talking about the bigger lessons of why the far right is growing. He quoted a writer from Mozambique who said, in times of terror, we elect monsters.
Yeah.
And that is true with, you know, obviously with Trump, with Bolsonaro, with Modi, with Orban, all of these people. And he was saying, you know, but I thought that was really interesting because, again, I think like we got to also consider the fact that people always talk about like resentment and fear. They always try to, especially in the United States, they always talk about the so-called white working class. And what I loved about the point he made, because I think a lot in Brazil and definitely in the United States, it's a lot of actually relatively affluent people, including ultra wealthy people, who not only don't want their position threatened, they don't even want to see other people with backgrounds culturally, racially, or economically even being in the same space. And that's what he identified in Brazil, because like, yeah, I did have a formula where everybody was winning, but they didn't want to see the poor winning, basically. And the only other thing I'd say, there's a lot more in the interview. I mean, and it is brilliant, but I do think the other part that I liked, and, you know, he was just very blunt. Like at one point he was like, yes, there is this global trend and it's happening. And, you know, this is how it works. But on the other hand, like, I think the way he put it, he's like, look, I know Hillary Clinton pretty well. The Democrats could have found a more appealing candidate.
He talked about her like she's just not an appealing person personally. That's not even up for debate.
Like maybe if Lula was running, we win. Maybe if Obama's running, we win. I just want to say one other last thing and then please take it over for everything. I think the other thing that's so important is just how earthy he is. Like, that is totally not in so much left politics here. Like, actually, Bernie does a good job of that, but he gets detailed. He was like, when I became president, I flew ministers who were bankers and doctors in my cabinet. He grew up in total poverty, but he knew that people in his cabinet didn't have that experience. And he's like, I flew them to the most poor, remote places in Brazil, and they'd have to go to a hut where somebody, and he says it, he's like, they have sex, they shit, they eat in the same room. They need to understand, they need to have that in their blood. That's why we're in office. And that is so simple because everybody's out like running around trying to figure it out. But it's that instinct, that gut, that commitment. That's what's so distinct. And that's what, you know, pretty much nobody else in politics. I do think Bernie has some of that. I think Jeremy Corbyn,
of course,
but has a lot of it, in fact. But it's distinct and it's also related to, you know, I mean, his very strong charisma.
Yeah, you know, because Greenwald, he brought up a point, which is probably a leftward critique, in that he's like, well, if we're going to have left leaders, if we're going to have people who are fighting for the rights of the most downtrodden people in our societies, shouldn't those people come from those places? And he pushed back against that. And that's why he used that example, right? He's like, it's not beyond the comprehension of a human being to recognize the humanity in somebody else, to know that this just should not be.
Right.
It's like, this is not beyond the comprehension of somebody who went to school and got to go to university and actually came up in a upper middle class background to understand that no human being should have to suffer this indignity. Right. Which I thought was a poignant, you know, point on his part. The idea that, you know, if you've never, you know, had to wash your clothes in the same sink, same toilet that you take a shit in, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Right. Like, if you've never had to do that, you can't understand why that's fucked up. Like, that's, you know, that's just a ridiculous notion. To me, not ridiculous, but I think it's misguided. The idea that you have to be black in order to understand the plight of the black man. No. Maybe you should go there. Maybe you should talk to the people who live like that. Maybe you should ask them what it takes to, you know, to endure on a day-to-day basis in their environments. And, you know, with that point, I completely agreed with him. And, you know, again, the clarity of vision is what's important to me. Just the ability to effectively communicate something without a bunch of bells and whistles. I think so many times, especially in our politics right now, right? And I talk about this all the time. Like, Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, like, have an idea. They have a platform. They have like a set of things they want to achieve, and they're putting them forth to potential people to vote for them. Right. Then we have motherfuckers like Biden. Then we have Beto. Then we have even a Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker, who, again, they're doing better than the Betos and the Bidens and fucking Mayor Pete, who is just basically.
Oh, I hate Mayor Pete, man. Mayor Pete just sucks.
He's the worst. And Biden's idea of just like, the second I arrive in the White House, Republicans are going to find Jesus again. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, how could that possibly be in the year of our Lord 2019? After you, motherfucker, were the vice president of Barack Hussein Obama, motherfucker. Like, you were that dude's vice president. This idea that Republicans are going to wake up tomorrow and not be Republican because Joe Biden showed up. It's laughable, right?
It's embarrassing.
And I think what Lula is just showing you, it's like, no, like, you know what's going to... Oh, and I love the crime question.
Oh.
I love the crime question where he's like, no, crime didn't go up. We're actually giving real stats. We're not juking the stats, but you know what? One of the biggest drug lords in the history of Brazil said his production went down 20% because the people that would normally be working in his cook factories... were able to get dignified work.
He said that was so, the way he finally got to, like, that's the other thing is you're exactly right. He always answers the question. And of course, like any politician, he puts it in his terms, but he basically was just like, Glenn, we counted crimes that were perpetuated against poor people instead of not including them. So we use actual stats.
Like, because that's something that goes on all the time out here in our own country. Like, my buddy Ethan, because he used to work in the crime division of some media entity. And he's like, one of my jobs was studying crime stats. And it's just like, it's obvious. If you incentivize better stats, that's what people are going to drive to. They're not going to stop. Rapes from occurring, they're going to misreport actual rapes so that they don't show up on the stats. And that's what Lula was saying. He's like, no, we're actually having transparent stats. You know why? Because we believe in the work that we're actually doing for people. We don't have to lie about what the crime stats are, because the bottom line is, how do you lift people up out of poverty? I don't know. Give them jobs so they have money. Let them know that these jobs are actually available to them. You know, avail them of education so that they can further embed themselves. You know, avail them to all the rights that, you know, certain elites take for granted. Like, it seems pretty simple to me. You want less crime? Give people money. Like, they won't feel the need to take your tennis shoes. He literally said that, or take your watch, because they can go out and buy their own. And guess what? They can go out and work for it. There's an opportunity for them to go out and get some paper in a dignified fashion, right? Obviously, the elites in this country and abroad and everywhere else, like, people thumb their nose at work. You know what I'm saying? While at the same time, while at the same time calling the downtrodden shiftless.
Yep. No, that's exactly. And I think, and that was the point that he was making, though, too, right? And I just want to say, like, a lot of other stuff we can't cover, but I just want to keep emphasizing that this is a man that grew up in serious poverty, had to drop out of school when he was 12. He worked as a metal worker and worked his way through the union movement, and then became this incredibly successful president and democracy and union leader. And, you know, he also has a section in the interview where he talks about the history of globalization. He talks about how we got where we are. He has a strategic understanding of where Brazil is positioned in terms of what he could and couldn't. You know, he's just, I mean, this guy is brilliant, and he already has proven success. And the underscore point is that he's in solitary confinement on ridiculous charges, which you can get in out. You know, we'll put links to segments I've done on my show into this website called the Brazil Wire, which everybody needs to read, in addition to obviously the interview with Glenn Greenwald. But I would just say, like, I do think, like, we'll look back on a time and, you know, all the mainstream media is garbage and lazy as fuck about this. They barely cover it. And then when they do, they just say, like, oh, he was convicted of corruption. Even though literally what he's they called it indeterminate acts is what they put him in jail for. This idiot Hasan Minhaj with his, like, whack Netflix show just repeated the same thing on Lula on a segment recently. So there's a lot of dishonesty and a lot of laziness about not only a great leader and politician who could be a net positive in a very dangerous time, but also something that, you know, the Brazilian elites and Western companies and U.S. foreign policy have played a role in, and then people are just lazily regurgitating it. And there's a huge history of that. I mean, how many great leaders, frankly, not even trying to do anything that radical? I mean, that's what's so funny is, like, you know, he's trying to do, like, what people like FDR did for Brazil. Like, this is not even radical, you know. And yet it still is suppressed. So I just think we all, you know, please speak out about it. Press your politicians on it. And also, if you watch the interview, it's like, oh, shit, maybe the best person we have in the game today is a political prisoner. That's wild.
Yeah. You know, again, it's Brazil's dynamic is a little bit different than ours. And you know, Lula even alluded to it. He was like, man, our slavery was a lot more recent. And, you know, the idea that I think in America, we're kind of past the point of we don't want to see black people at the airport. But it's like, we don't want to do anything to help them get there. We're not gonna lift a finger to actually help.
Hey, you're there. That's fine.
But that's, I mean, cool. Shit. But, like, don't ask me to do anything about it. What the hell are you talking about? You know. But yeah, I just thought it was a fascinating. It was a fascinating look at a guy who has actually done something for people. And a lot of times people get so cynical about politics, man. But it's not. It's really not hard. Once he breaks it down to you how the poorest people in Brazilian society are forced to live, it's not hard to understand why somebody might want to make it their life's mission to make it not so. Right. Yeah. Like, it's so clear. It's so easy to me. Once once you break it down to its core components, it's like, listen, like, he's like, just listen to the actual reality of the poorest Brazilian's life. Just think about that. Just think about that. Like, what type of nobody deserves that, bro. And so, you know, I just thought it was a really cool look. You know, he's obviously passionate about, you know, the cause of working, working people, the forgotten people of society. And it's, you know, quite refreshing, man.
Absolutely. So, you know, they say in Portuguese, Lula Livre. You could probably, I mean, you can see me on the t-shirt fairly frequently, actually. Another story that is in a different realm, but is actually very inspiring. So what's Rihanna up to, and what was she talking with the New York Times about?
Man, so recently Rihanna sat down with the New York Times T Magazine, I believe it's called. She sat down with a brother named, hold on, I want to make sure I'm getting this man's name right, because he gave a fantastic interview. A brother named Jeremy O. Harris. He's a playwright. He's an actor. It was just basically about Rihanna joining forces with the LVMH. I just know the Louis Vuitton portion. The LVMH fashion house, which is basically the biggest, most powerful fashion house in the fashion conglomerate in the world, right? Like, these people do billions with a B of revenue every single year. And you know, they just talked about the significance of what it means for her to be partnering with these people, to be the first person, the first Black woman to head up a fashion line with LVMH. And they're starting from scratch with her. It's just an incredible story. And like, you know, a lot of people who listen to this know I'm a fan of Rihanna's work. I'm a fan of her as a person. I just honestly feel a certain connectedness to her because, you know, she's an immigrant from the Caribbean. Like, my own mother's an immigrant from the Caribbean, immigrant woman from the Caribbean. All of my aunts are, you know, the people who basically raised me. My oldest sister is, like, I feel very connected to her and her story, right? And, right, you know, oftentimes in this piece, they talk about, like, what it's like to be you and do the things that you're doing. And I just admire Rihanna's fearlessness, man. I don't know how else to say it besides it's inspiring to hear her say, like, look, I am who I am, but nobody's gonna shake me from that, right? Like, despite what it might mean in this industry to these people that I'm doing the things that I'm doing, I can't not be me. And I have to be me for the people that came before me, the people who are going to come after me, the little girls that are going to read this this magazine, quite frankly. Like, I have to be Rihanna, and I have to do so in the most authentic manner possible. And, you know, of course, we talk about shit. Like, about the perils of capitalism and, of, you know, on the one hand, this is just another capitalistic endeavor, right? It is just a means to make more money through clothes or through makeup or through whatever. But I think there's just something a little bit more distinct about what Rihanna's doing in her own path, right? They talk about in the article how, before she got into the makeup game, like, the color palettes were extremely limited, right, specifically for women, for Black women, you know. And this is something I remember talking to people close to me, because I'm a skeptic, right? Like, I see Rihanna moving all this moving all this makeup, and I'm like, really, guys? Like, you guys are, like, is, and I asked a friend of mine, a Black woman, and I'm like, what's so good about this Rihanna makeup that's, like, that you couldn't get with from, say, Maybelline? And she's like, dude, like, she's literally servicing Black women. Straight up. Right. Obviously, she has stuff for white women, Asian women, blah, blah, blah. But she is the first major brand out there, mass produced, that Black women can go and find stuff that they can actually use themselves straight from the store. It was revolutionary and groundbreaking. I was just like, wow. Like, just the idea that this never occurred to somebody else, just out of pure capitalistic motivations, this never even occurred to somebody. So it's just like, you know, the vein of her capitalism, not to say that it's, like, somehow less capitalist, you know what I'm saying? Like, because it's not. But the things that she's doing and how they affect you know, specific communities. I just thought it spoke to me. And just, you know, as because she is a public figure, and my favorite part about Rihanna, quite honestly, has always been how she's famous, right? Like what, how she chooses to conduct her fame. Like, she's not hiding from people. She's not hiding who she is from anything. Like, you know, they mentioned her walking out of a restaurant with a wine glass in her hand. Like, whatever. I don't give a fuck. You know what I'm saying? And that always felt so authentic. Like, she's just like, I know people are watching me, but I'm not going to let it affect me and who I am and how I present to the world. And I just think it's so powerful. And I think that's why, you know, to put our brand strategist hats on, like we used to do with Dope Boys.
Right. Yes.
I think the authenticity of her quote unquote brand is just, you can't bottle that up. You cannot fake it. And there's a reason why people connect to her in the way that she does. And, you know, I don't want to do the rote comparisons of Rihanna and Beyonce. But it, here I feel like it's instructive because obviously Beyonce is a powerful voice. She is a motivational voice for women and specifically women of color all around the world in her own way. But she did come out with a clothing brand. She's come out with several clothing brands and they kind of weren't, you know, very successful because guess what? The people never really wanted that from her, right? That's not what the people cared about Beyonce for. But when you see when Rihanna drops her stuff, people, for whatever reason, people feel like they are Rihanna, right? With Beyonce, is something that it's almost unachievable. It's aspirational.
Yeah, I think that's I mean, it's funny that you, because what is the, I don't know how you tease that apart, but like the difference, like obviously, I mean, it feels funny to say it because of course Rihanna is unbelievably glamorous and beautiful and brilliant and successful, but yeah, Beyonce is selling, and I think the reason it works is I think it's authentic. She is, I mean, you know, nobody's perfect, but she's got perfection. Like, she really, you know, it's just everything's choreographed, everything. I mean, it's just, she just nails it. What I like also about Rihanna, what I think really shines through in this interview is what I feel is like, you know, especially now, right? Because I feel like the mode we're in now, it, you know, and I say this a lot when we talk about, I mean, we're going to touch on Biggie in a minute, but I feel like it could be a lot of different types of figures. In some way, it could be anybody from Nas to Willie Nelson to, you know, like there's a certain type of like rawness that's very popular right now. Yeah. And I feel like it wasn't even popular necessarily even a couple years ago. And, you know, Rihanna, it, you know, people always make this point, but it's true. Like when you've been on something before everybody tries to be on it, it's a huge advantage. And I just, Rihanna out of the gate has always been the one. Like now I feel like, you know, your PR person might be like, hey, you know what? Why don't you step out of that bar with some wine?
Right.
Years ago, it might have been like, hey, you're not the Clash. Like, you're not, you know, like, you're not trying to sell. Like, come on. Like, you're fucking, you know, you're a beautiful woman. And, like, yeah. Of course, yes, you're very, you know, it's very sexual and it's very edgy, but, you know, it's love ballads and you're supposed, and it's glamour. Like, she was putting out, like, do you remember when that Bobby Shmurda thing went viral a couple years ago? And, like, granted, everybody for us, I think when that was happening, a lot of people went on Snapchat and Instagram and played Bobby Shmurda and did the dance.
Yeah.
But it was like a lot of, you know, it was like other rapper. It was a lot of people like in that realm. And then when you saw one where it was like, oh, Rihanna's like smoking a blunt, listening to Bobby Shmurda. Like,
yeah.
Forget that might have actually bought, like, the conventional wisdom of that time would have been if you do that, you don't get to be the first black woman to head a major fashion house in Paris. So I think it's just cool that that sort of core attitude or whatever you want to call it, she did it before it was the thing to do. And, you know, now it carries through into all these different realms of success, basically.
Yeah. And you know, honestly, for me, and again, like, I was emotionally moved by her words, as ridiculous as that might sound.
No,
like,
no, it was a good interview.
This person is, you know, and as a Black person out in the world, it's damn near impossible to achieve absolute freedom, right? Specifically in a capitalistic society. And of course, the interviewer had to ask, because obviously this shit is making tons and tons of money. And she's like, well, that money is just an expression of what I can do for other people, right? Yeah. And it's like, yep, what's the point, yep, of this shit if I can't take care of my family, if I can't create jobs, if I can't help the next Rihanna build the next fashion house at LVMH? Like, you know, this money is just a vehicle to do shit for other people, which I think is an important message. And by the way, the cynics out there be like, yeah, whatever, I'm sure she doesn't mean it, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. That's what she said. That's what she chose to put out in the public, right? It's not, oh, my motivation is to, you know, sell more clothes than Celine does or sell more clothes than Chanel does during the next season. It's not that. It's like, yo, this money shit is dope because it allows me to do, you know, certain different things. And I just think, but to get back to what I was saying, like, I just think Rihanna embodies just a certain freedom of spirit and just freedom of being that is just, you know, it's, again, it's inspiring for somebody like me who just generally the shit I see on the internet just makes me roll my eyes, right? And even this Rihanna interview, which I'm a big fan of Rihanna's, but I just took my time and I was like, oh, I don't know, whatever. But then, you know, something clicked with me. It's like, she's doing something really important, right? Again, you can say what you want about, you know, this just being another corporate sponsorship and a lot of the pieces going for $1,500, blah, 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 blah. You can say what you want about that. The bottom line is this is a powerful fucking entity and they have empowered freaking Robin Fenty to do something for them. Right? Like, it's unescapable how important that is. No matter what your critiques are of capitalism, like, this achievement is an important one. And I just love the message that she embodies, man.
I love she says, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. I'm going to take control of my vision, my sound, my clothes. I also embrace changes along the way, things that make me a better woman, a better human being, like even the way I communicate. I'm really proud of my growth in that. I'm proud to walk into any building as this person. Nothing makes me embarrassed about me. And so it's so funny because when I was reading that at first, the first part of like, I'm going to do whatever I want, I'm going to take control of my vision, you know, I'm like, okay, whatever, you know, cool, good, absolutely, go for it. But there's nothing like that's, I've heard a million everybody say that.
Yeah.
But when you make it the combination of that full confidence in the face of everything that, you know, she has faced and dealt with, and then also even just like the humility of like this global icon, superstar, artist, performer, businesswoman saying like, hey, I've improved the way I've communicated. You know, yeah, like, and the truth is, like, we all should be trying to do that. Every single fucking person, but nobody, like, when's the next time you're going to hear that from another CEO or another whatever?
Mike, just imagine this interview was being given by, I don't know, Elon Musk.
Yeah. I mean, at least try to think of somebody who's not so fucking ridiculous and nonsensical as Elon Musk. You can't, dude, a show on Lula and Rihanna, you can't bring up Elon Musk. That just degrades everything. Come on.
It's just, imagine him in Rihanna's position. What this man would say about himself, bro. Like, and you know, and that's what, it's hard for me not to think about those things as I'm reading this, you know. And I do want to share a passage that, you know, that spoke to me, and it did speak about being rich, being famous, being Black. The interviewer goes, I can't get over the fact that, you know, the fashion industry is historically so explicitly white, it's so racist, it's so classist, and it's so sexist. Had there been moments where as a Black woman, you felt like an outsider in this space, or does being Rihanna alleviate that? She, Rihanna goes, it's never alleviated. You know, you're going to be a black wherever you go. And I don't know if it's unfortunate or fortunate because I love being black. So sorry for those who don't like it. That's the first thing you say before you even hear my voice. There are also other factors. I'm young. I'm new to the family. I'm a woman. Those factors do come into play, but I will not apologize for them, and I will not back down for being a woman, from being black, from having an opinion. I'm running a company, and that's exactly what I came here to do. I don't know if it makes people uncomfortable or not, but that's not even my business, you know? I do know that the reason I'm here is not because I'm black. It's because of what I have to offer. And that's what they're interested in. And the fact that I'm black is just that, a fact.
It's funny that she said that, like, because I can't picture, like, when she talks about communicating well, I'm like, yeah, I don't recall a time where Rihanna wasn't a very clear communicator. But the other thing too is I just want to say really quick on the, like, yeah, you know, like, I do for sure, right? I'm a socialist. I look at capitalism as, you know,
evil, a scourge.
I don't even, you know, to be honest with you, it's like, in some ways I can put it even less dramatic than that. I just think it's a technology, if you want to use that analogy or metaphor, that's like done. You know, like, we got to evolve out of it if we want to survive as a species. Sure. And it's also a system that is horrible for a lot of human beings. And obviously, you know, particularly those, you know, at the extreme ends of the exploitation chain, but even those who aren't, right? But that being said, part of the reason that, at least, you know, for me, like, I always have, you know, had, even besides like some of the work that I did, an interest in brands and how they interact with culture, is because, first of all, you can't be like a scourge. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm a socialist, but I love when I get my Adidas boxes in the mail, and I make no apologies for that.
Same. And the second thing is,
as anybody who watches me on YouTube knows. And the second thing I would say is that it would be foolish. Like, look, if somebody said, oh, because Rihanna has that position, that shows that, you know, we don't have to deal with capitalism. We don't have to deal with inequality because we can make the 1%, you know, look diverse, right? If that's your argument, then no, I'll fight that all day.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you were to just say, it doesn't matter, it's all just capitalism. No, the culture, the possibility. I mean, tracing back to Lula, I mean, yes, first and foremost, it's all the great things he did as a president and as a leader. But you don't think that that doesn't unlock the sense of possibility for other kids that had to drop out and shine shoes or work in a metal factory? And so, you know, these things really matter. It matters that she's in that position. It matters that she, you know, that matters regardless of how far it goes.
Yeah, man. You know, to that point, I can give a personal anecdote, right? A few weeks back, Stephen A. Smith was at the Clippers playoff game. And he's basically, you know, one of the five most important people in media, in sports media. Like, there's no two ways about it. But he also happens to be from Hollis, Queens. He also happens to be black. And he also happens to talk in a sort of way that I identify with, right? Like, I grew up in Queens Village, which is the adjacent neighborhood to Hollis. I am a black person. I happen to kind of talk like Stephen A. Smith. There's something affirming self-affirming about knowing that Stephen A. Smith is from where I'm from. He talks how I talk. He looks like me. For myself, right? Yep. For somebody who does have confidence in their abilities to, you know, do whatever job that I'm in. But there's just something affirming about, like, damn, Stephen A. Smith is one of the most important people in media, and he's from where I'm from. He talks like how I talk. He looks how I look. Like, you know, that's just a fact. Like, you could say it sounds corny. You could say whatever you want. It just is what it is.
Anybody who said it sounds corny, I mean, that's just – I mean, look, I'm not in any way comparing it at all, because it's different stakes and different history. Although obviously, you know, Jewish people do have a history. And, you know, I don't think that this Trump – look, if Bernie Sanders was, you know, who he is, but he supported NAFTA and took money from Wall Street. Obviously, I wouldn't vote for him. And so I support him because of policy. But there's no, but the part of me that's just like, oh, Bernie, come on. I fucking love this guy. That's because he could have been one of my uncles.
Exactly.
You kidding me? It's because I could have met him at some family Seder and been like, oh, like, Uncle Bernie is mad about what Reagan's doing in Latin America. Listen, I love it. I mean, it's great. And that's great. That's one of the most simple expressions of all of these things, right? It's just the experience that you don't get to have yourself, whoever you are, you know, affirmed publicly or culturally. I mean, that matters. Like, I think that's the part of like this argument that's getting messed up is that on one hand, there is a contingent of people, particularly people who cluster around like the kind of fake woke, like Hillary Clinton, Daily Show kind of mindset that they're saying that's all you need. Like, right. Hey, let's keep the schools start. Let's still have structural poverty. Let's not deal with anything, but let's just affirm that in public.
Right. Or not even deal with
the
other
hand, if you were to say that that was nothing, you would in fact be, and you know, I don't use terminology like this a lot, frankly, anymore, but like that would be pure white privilege to say that. It literally would be.
Well, Mike, and again, it ignores the obvious implicit idea that, yes, as special as Rihanna is, she is not the first black woman born capable of doing the job that she's in.
Of course.
Like, that's the other part that neoliberals don't get. It's like, no, like, yes, we're going to acknowledge Rihanna for being special, but like, she's not that special. You know what I'm saying? Like, certain types of neoliberals will have you believe, like, no, the reason why Rihanna did it is because of the meritocracy. She was one of the only people who could get through it because she's so special. Just like all of us at Harvard, we're so special. Because our daddy bought a building, we're so special, right? And it's just, you know, it's just the obvious stupid critique of, you know, neoliberalism and all that jazz.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, that's so – please, everybody, we'll obviously also have that in the show notes. Definitely read that interview. And, you know, I would say really, I mean, share it. I mean, it is not, you know, I would have, you know, took a look at it anyways because I like Rihanna. She's cool. But there's nutrition. There's stuff in there that even if you don't care at all about Rihanna or fashion or whatever, that's definitely relevant for kind of understanding how the world works. The last thing that we just wanted to hit for a minute was that this past week it would have been Notorious B.I.G.'s 47th birthday. And, you know, it's always an opportunity. Like on my show, actually, in the shout out, we talked about it. Found this clip of him freestyling when he was 17. And yeah. I mean, I don't know. His charisma really was just kind of insane. But the other part that I just wanted to hit and go, you know, whatever, you know, I mean, I'll just say this really quickly. I think especially, you know, the public perception of the 90s, especially, you know, the 90s get further and further away and 90s kids get older and older, which is terrifying. You have this idea. It was like, oh, yeah, it was Bill Clinton and the stock market was like even people who think like, oh, that was a lot of false prosperity because it was juicing the stock market and it was the tech bubble and there were all these fundamental problems that were going to come into view later, which they did. That's all true. But there was still, you know, even then, like, and the culture was obviously so much more centralized in terms of, you know, you couldn't access, I mean, forget even like alternative media. Like, I guess you could read The Nation or whatever, which a couple hundred thousand people did. But you couldn't like even have all these other conversations that people have today, which is an advantage of social media, right? That you can be like, well, I don't think what ABC or MSNBC or Fox is doing, like, I think that Lula interview is important. Or in fact, I think the fact that, you know, we have all these videos of police murdering black people across the country, let's center that. Or, you know, this protest or wherever, or this artistic movement, what, you know, my point. And so when these records like Ready to Die came out, and I think Ready to Die particularly, as I re-listened to it, like, that was a pretty amazing, like, counterpoint to all of the bullshit of the 90s from Rudy Giuliani's this great guy who cleaned up New York. That was the total mainstream narrative about Rudy Giuliani, like a guy who everybody now recognizes as like this decrepit, insane racist. But everybody wanted to give him all sorts of credit, even though probably there were bigger factors in place that would have happened anyways. And a lot of what he did was really just terrorizing the underclass and people of color in New York, and also accelerating the corporate domination of New York City. And so that album is just like the retort to me of all of the presuppositions about what was actually happening at that time. It was like, no, actually, there's still very little resources and there's still very limited opportunity. Oh, and by the way, if I'm quote unquote materialistic or into buying shit or into luxury brands, maybe it's because the entirety of this whole culture is.
Yeah, the idea that you wouldn't like stuff in America. And oftentimes, you know, I'm not going to lie, I get on my high horse to my girlfriend or even to my mom about their affinity for stuff, as if, you know, like you said, when that StockX package came through the mail with them Jordan 4s, I wasn't like, ooh. So, yes, I'm a hypocrite like everybody else. I take ownership in that. But, you know, again, just to sort of address what you were saying, you know, when we do talk about the go-go 80s and, you know, the prosperity of the 90s, like, we know who was actually gaining from all of that prosperity, right? It wasn't working people. Like, working people's wages weren't going up. Working people's conditions weren't getting better. It was all still going to the top. Like, and that's been the trend since basically, you know, our government has decided to completely and utterly align itself, both parties, with the corporate class. Like, that goes without saying. And obviously, Ready to Die speaks to that. You know, with Big's birthday coming up, of course, it made me think of Nipsey Hussle, who died, you know, 9 years older than Big was when he died, but still a very young man. And it made me just think about, like, all the things that Big might have accomplished, you know, within the last 22 years, right? Like, all of the people he might have empowered. You know, that's even without talking about some of the great works that he might have put out. You know, what type of father he would have been to his kids, you know. Yeah. It made me think about that type of stuff. But it also made me just proud that 22 years later, that his presence still looms very large within the culture. I think his spirit, his essence imbues a lot of what's still even popular now. You know, just the idea, just the confidence, the brashness, the idea that somebody who's as dark skinned and fat and whatever as Big was could fancy himself as a ladies' man, like, you know, just his spirit, I feel like it's still, you know, it's all, it's his DNA is all over what we do still within the culture today. And for him to just get to 24 years old and be able to accomplish all of that, it makes me proud to call myself somebody, you know, who's part of hip hop culture and, you know, a culture that's gone from the freaking Bronx to Shanghai, literally. Right. I remember being in freaking Barcelona and seeing like graffiti on the walls and just thinking like, wow, damn, that's fucking hip hop. Like, how humbling that shit was. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, the guy is a champion of the culture that we, you know, we hold dear to ourselves. Obviously, he's one of my favorite rappers ever. Obviously, as somebody who was living in Brooklyn when he died, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm proud to call myself a Brooklynite, even though Brooklyn and Queens people give me a hard time about my dual citizenship. you know, more than anything, I feel proud that the guy was, even in his limited time on the earth, he was able to make such an incredible impact, man.